Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of Saturday's talks between the P5+1 and Iran in Istanbul that might avert another war in the Middle East, since President Obama has warned that the window for diplomacy is closing. Colin Carl, who was Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for the Middle East at the Pentagon from 2009 to 2011, joins us to discuss a possible deal as the clock ticks on an Israeli strike against Iran's nuclear facilities. Then we will look ahead to the coming world with multiple centers of power and no global hegemon. Charles Kupchan, a former head of European affairs on the National Security Council, joins us to discuss his new book, No One's World, The West, The Rising East, and The Coming Global Turn, which makes the case we are entering a world of conflicting values and multiple paths to prosperity that not many Western policymakers and pundits want to contemplate, let alone prepare for. Then finally, on Tax Day, we will speak with the nation's leading expert on taxes and who pays them, David K. Johnston. A Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter, he is a columnist for Reuters, where he has an article, Taxed by the Boss, a shocking expose that reveals how more than 2,700 of the biggest corporations like GE, GM, Goldman Sachs, and Procter & Gamble are collecting state income taxes from hundreds of thousands of workers and pocketing them with the state's approval. Joining us now is Colin Carl, who's a professor in the Security Studies program at the Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. From February 2009 to December 2011, he was a Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for the Middle East at the Pentagon. In that capacity, he served as a senior policy advisor to the Secretary of Defense for Egypt, Iran, Iraq, Israel, and the Palestinian territories, Saudi Arabia, Syria, Yemen, and six other countries in the Levant and the Persian Gulf. Colin Carl is the author of State Scarcity and Civil Strife in the Developing World and is a regular consultant to the Department of Defense and the intelligence community. Welcome to Background Briefing, Colin Carl.
Thanks for having me.
And the P5 plus one, the permanent five on the UN Security Council plus Germany, their meeting took place in Istanbul on Saturday with the Iranians, led by their national security advisor, Saeed Jalili, who apparently is very close to the supreme leader. Apparently, according to the European representative, Ms. Ashton, everything went very well. However, one thing that puzzled me is that apparently the United States tried to get the Iranian delegation to meet separately, and that was turned down by the Iranians. In other words, the U.S. wanted to hold some bilateral talks on the side with the Iranians, and they rejected that. What's your understanding of that?
Yeah, I don't think we have the full details. The Iranians did meet in a couple of bilaterals. They had a bilateral with the EU representative, Catherine Ashton, Lady Ashton, who you mentioned a minute ago. They also held bilaterals with China and Russia. The U.S. representative, Undersecretary Wendy Sherman, had noted that she was willing to meet with any of the parties there to discuss the agenda items. But we have conflicting reports as to whether a formal ask was made of the Iranians and whether they turned it down. I don't know that we should make too much of that. I think at some point everybody understands that serious bilateral conversations will have to happen between the United States and Iran to resolve this issue. But at this stage, I think U.S. negotiators are also sensitive to the point that there's a lot of domestic controversy associated with kind of jumping into the deep end of the pool on bilateral negotiations with the Americans too early in the process.
So what do you make then, Colin Carl, of the talks being held now in May the 23rd in Baghdad? Apparently the Iranians also suggested Beirut and Damascus, clearly locations over which they have influence. And I don't think anybody's ever going to show up in Damascus. But we've got, 6 weeks here? Is that a case of kicking the can down the road? Given the urgency of the talks and President Obama framing these talks as warning that the window for diplomacy is closing?
Yeah, I actually think there were several good signs that came out of the talks. First, Iran was willing to seriously discuss their nuclear program, which they had not been in the previous talks 15 months ago in Istanbul, where they were basically wanted to talk about everything but their nuclear program. There was a high degree of unity among the P5+1 countries. One of Iran's tactics historically has been to try to divide the international community, but the international community was united in this case. Third, they did set a date for a follow-on meeting in Baghdad on May 23rd, and they agreed to hold interim technical discussions to make sure that meeting was more productive. I think the Iranian representatives at the meeting signaled a desire to delay the EU oil sanctions, and what I take from that is that they're worried about the economic effect of sanctions, so that indicates there might be some leverage over them. But at the same time, Iranian representatives framed the talks as representing a spirit of cooperation, and they reiterated the Supreme Leader's fatwa or religious edict against the use or possession of nuclear weapons. And I think they did all of that in order to frame the issue in a way that, a possible compromise down the road could be sold domestically. So I kind of see all of these things as not just mere atmospherics, not just talk about more talk, but actually building up to something. But as you mentioned, what that something will be, we don't know yet. And the Obama administration's been pretty clear that they are open to diplomacy, but diplomacy won't be open-ended.
And Colin Carr, what do you make then of, obviously, there's no unanimity amongst the P5 plus one. However, Russia started off the talks, apparently, and the Iranians thanked the Russians, and the Russian delegate bluntly said, Russia doesn't have to be thanked. We need you to do what we need you to do. What explains the fact that the Russians, who have good relations with Iran, and the Chinese, who have enormous trading ties, not the least of which is they're one of the main customers for Iranian oil, what explains their apparent annoyance with Iran?
Well, I think because Iran has gone for more than a year with being basically unresponsive to diplomatic outreach. The Russians have been trying to get them to be serious about what they call their step-by-step approach. That the Chinese, for their part, are very much worried not only about energy sanctions that have been put in place by the United States, by the Europeans and others, but also about the prospect of a war in the Middle East triggered by an Israeli strike sometime in the next few months. So I think the patience level on both the Russian side and the Chinese side is pretty low at the moment, which is why I think actually the P5 plus one was a little bit more unified than is sometimes the case. I think the true test, however, will be, you know, when they meet in Baghdad and concrete proposals are actually put on the table, you know, how much agreement there is among the P5 plus one countries. And so I think one of the challenges between now and then will be for the representatives of the P5 plus one to try to create as a united a position on going into those negotiations as possible.
Well, I guess on the surface, one can make the assumption, Colin Carr, that there's at least 6 weeks have been bought in terms of delaying any possible strike.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I think that I think the Iranians clearly don't have an interest in Israel striking. The P5 plus one countries don't have an interest in Israel striking. And I think that your intuition is right, that it will be more difficult for the Israelis to strike as negotiations go on. But I'll tell you, that only will probably last for so long. I mean, the talks at some point have to bear fruit, or the Israelis will declare the talks a failure, and they'll move on to other options. So I think everybody is cognizant that nobody's looking to just run out the clock on the Israelis here. I think the Americans, for sure, are interested in trying to get a concrete set of compromises in the near term that will help address some of those core issues, such as 20% enrichment and the installation of centrifuges at the Fordo enrichment facility in the mountain near Qom, that are really driving Israeli anxieties and American anxieties, frankly. So I think unless there's concrete progress in the next several weeks, you know, the talking is not going to hold the Israelis off for very long.
Again, I'm speaking with Colin Carr. He's a professor in the Security Studies program at the Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. From February 2009 to December 2011, he was the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for the Middle East at the Pentagon and is the author of States, Scarcity, and Civil Strife in the Developing World, and is a regular consultant to the Department of Defense and the intelligence community. Well, of course, I think these talks are happening, and the extent to which there's optimism as a result of Saturday's talks between the P5 plus one and Iran probably are the result of these sanctions. And they really start to kick in, I understand, in a few months' time. France, curiously enough, when I mentioned earlier, Colin Carr, that there's no unanimity amongst the P5 plus one, France is to the right of the U.S. on this, almost taking the position of the Israelis. So the long and the short of it is, though, I think, isn't it the point is when the Asian customers stopped buying Iranian oil, they're going to have to shift their refineries over to a different formula because of the nature of Iranian oil. That's an expensive process. And once they do that, it's less likely that they'll turn back. So I take it that there's some serious leverage that these sanctions are developing.
No, I mean, I think there's tremendous and increasing leverage. I mean, even last December, we were hearing noises out of the Iranians about how these sanctions were the worst sanctions they've ever experienced. And that was before the U.S. went forward with its Central Bank of Iran sanctions, which could effectively cut off a large number of Iran's potential energy customers from the U.S. banking system if they don't curtail purchases of Iranian oil. That's already led to a decline in purchases among some. And then the EU, the European Union, followed up with a decision to put in place an oil embargo. Now both of those don't fully kick in until the end of June and into July. So we have this moment, I think, of significant leverage. And I think evidence for that is the fact that Jalili apparently, at the negotiations in Istanbul, asked Ashton for the sanctions to be lifted or to be delayed. Ashton was noncommittal on that and basically said, any talk of that was premature and would have to be in response to concrete steps to address the international community's objections to the way Iran is conducting its nuclear activities. So I do think there's considerable leverage. I do think the Iranians are worried about it, and the task for our diplomats between now and the Baghdad talks is to figure out how to use that leverage.
But there is something that I've never understood in terms of a kind of disconnect here. Iran is under four sets of UN sanctions for refusing to stop uranium enrichment. They say they need to go to 20% to get medical isotopes for 150,000 Iranians suffering from cancer, I imagine. To solve that problem is relatively easy, to provide small amounts of uranium for these production of medical isotopes. And the fact that they've moved their centrifuges to this underground, somewhat impregnable facility they built at Fordo, which they didn't declare until it was found, that has led, I guess, to a lot of skepticism. So the reasons that they need to enrich to 20% and they have a sovereign right to do so, they are signatories to the NPT. I imagine during these talks they brought up the fact that the Israelis aren't and that they have a mature nuclear arsenal. But the long and the short of it is the Iranian position's never made any sense in terms of the pain that this alleged need for nuclear enrichment is inflicted upon the country. And the fact that it could be easily solved leads one to be suspicious of what they're up to.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, it only makes sense in a world in which the Iranians are engaged in what nuclear proliferation experts call a nuclear hedging strategy. That is, they're doing all sorts of activities ostensibly under the cover of civilian purposes. So enriching to 3.5% for nuclear reactors that they don't have or that are already fueled by Russian fuel, and enriching up to 20% for a research reactor, the Tehran research reactor, when they could get that fuel from outside and have already been offered that fuel from outside. The reason they're doing all these things, though, is to perfect the fuel cycle, and proliferation analysts think, in order to put themselves into a position to eventually be able to make the decision to weaponize their nuclear program if they decided to do so. So the reason most Iran analysts think that they're willing to endure all this pain is that they want to get as close to the line of a nuclear weapons breakout capability as they can, because frankly, having a virtual or an actual nuclear weapons arsenal would be seen by the regime as highly advantageous. So I think that's the only explanation for why they're willing to endure this much pain. That said, they're clearly worried about the pain, and the question will be in the next couple months whether that pain is sufficient to get them to start to scale back their program and start to meet more of their international obligations.
And I understand, Colin Kyle, that from the intelligence community, there's widespread belief that the Iranians actually have Chinese nuclear devices, blueprints, whatever, that they got from AQ Khan. So, you know, technically, it wouldn't be that difficult for them to move ahead once they get the nuclear fuel.
Well, the intelligence community, in terms of their open testimony and some of the open source material, has been pretty consistent. Iran currently has enough low-enriched uranium to produce as many as four nuclear weapons, should they decide to do so. If they started to enrich their low-enriched uranium up to weapons-grade level, it would take them at least 4 months after diverting their stockpile and recalibrating their centrifuges. It would take them at least 4 months to create the fissile material, the weapons-grade material, for one bomb. But it would take a year total to transform all the research and development that they may have done into weaponization into an actual crude device. Now, this wouldn't be something they could put on the tip of a missile, that would take several more years. We're talking about a device they might be able to put in a ship or in a truck or something like that. So the intelligence community has been pretty consistent that from the point of a decision by Iran's supreme leader, it would take Iran a year to go for a bomb. But analysts have also been careful to point out they're highly unlikely to make that decision anytime soon, because to make that decision would require them to enrich to weapons grade at declared facilities at Natanz or Fordo, and therefore they'd get caught by the international community, and that would bring the house down on them, to include likely military action by the United States and others.
So why then is Israel pushing so hard, and through their supporters in the U.S. Congress? Senator Lieberman has got an amendment, which I think is going to be debated in the Senate this week, which is essentially would foreclose these very talks that are taking place. So why do that? Why, you know, why not allow diplomacy a chance? And what explains the very hawkish position from the Israelis?
Yeah, the Israelis actually don't have a fundamentally different understanding of the Iranian nuclear program than the U.S. intelligence community. The biggest difference is the fact that the Israelis have far fewer military capabilities than the United States. I mean, Israel is a potent military force, the most powerful military force in the Middle East, but they don't have the capability to set back the Iranian program in the way that the United States military does. And this facility that we've talked about, this Fordo enrichment plant, which was previously covert and then was outed by the Obama administration in the fall of 2009, is 200 or 300 feet underground in the side of a mountain. I mean, it's one of these kind of James Bond supervillain type of places. And the Israelis have been consistent that they don't have the conventional capability to destroy this facility. So as the Iranians have started to make that facility operational this year, Israeli leaders, principally Minister of Defense Ehud Barak, have really emphasized what he calls the risk that Iran will enter the so-called zone of immunity. That is, that across a certain threshold, it's not that Iran will suddenly have a bomb, it's that Iran's program, their program will be unreachable by Israeli bombs. That is, Israel won't be able to set the program back. So it creates kind of a now-or-never moment for the Israelis. If they don't strike Iran's program this year, they argue, it'll be much more difficult for them to set back the program in the future. And so the only possibility, if they don't strike this year, would be to rely on the United States and the international community to do it. And then there's a question about whether they, you know, have faith that the international community would actually do it if Israel doesn't.
Well, I've been reading some recent articles. There was an article in Foreign Policy suggesting that Israel has made some arrangements with Azerbaijan to land their planes after a strike, which would make it much more feasible because, you know, they'd be pushing their air force to the limits to enact an attack on Iran, which I think you've indicated wouldn't even work because they don't have the ability to get to this underground facility. But nevertheless, they've been pretty clear that, you know, there's been a lot of high-ranking intelligence people in Israel expressing concern. They may well have arrangements with the Iraqi Kurds as well. So would you agree that at this point, Israel at least has the idea that they wouldn't be able to pull this off technically is no longer applicable?
It completely depends on what you're talking about. There's two technical limitations. One is fuel, and if they potentially have places to bed down in Azerbaijan or somewhere in Iraq or somewhere, it could help them mitigate some of the fuel concerns, because otherwise they have to send, you know, almost 100 aircraft 1,000 miles and do some extraordinarily complex in-air refueling. It would be by far the most complex thing the Israeli Air Force has ever done. If they were able to land somewhere else, that may make it a little easier. But the other limitation is that they don't have the munitions, that is the sufficient size of bunker-busting bombs, to get into the Fordo facility. That's they've talked about that themselves. So even if you were able to mitigate some of the refueling problems, it doesn't actually make the Iranian sites necessarily more vulnerable to Israeli attack. You know, some people ask, then why shouldn't the United States provide Israel with the bunker busters to make sure that they can get into Iranian facilities? And the answer to that is Israel already has all the bunker busters in their inventory that their aircraft are capable of delivering. The one game-changing munition is the one developed by the U.S. Air Force called the Massive Ordnance Penetrator, which is a 30,000-pound beast of a bomb that can only be dropped by a B-2 stealth bomber. So the Israelis simply have no capability to drop something like that, even if we were to provide them one.
Well, just in closing, though, Colin Cowell, I don't understand, though, why or how this threat is actual leverage. As you know, this is an election year from the National Defense Authorization Act, which Senators McCain and Lieberman and Graham pushed. The president threatened to veto that because he felt that it tied his hands on Iran and would force the price of oil up. Any military strike would not only force the price of oil up, it would probably cause a global recession or depression even. It's a catastrophic red line. So I'm curious to know why I suppose in order to have the leverage that brings Iran to the table, you have to exercise the threat. But the threat itself is so catastrophic. It's almost takes you back to the days of mutually assured destruction with nuclear weapons.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how seriously the Iranians take the threat. I think the Iranians probably aren't sure whether the Israelis will really do it. They may feel like at the end of the day, if the Americans don't support the Israelis doing it, the Israelis won't do it. But on the other hand, you have an Israeli prime minister who regularly refers to a nuclear-armed Iran as risking a second Holocaust and defining it in the most stark of existential terms, suggesting that Israel won't wait forever. And Israel doesn't have a history of letting its neighbors develop nuclear weapons. They have a history of striking those programs before they're developed. They hit the Iraqi program in 1981. They hit the Syrian program in 2007. So there's just nothing in Israeli history to suggest they would remain constrained. As it relates to the oil price issue, I suspect the Israelis believe that oil prices would go up by $20, $30, $40 a barrel for a couple of weeks, but then the conflict would settle down and the oil prices would settle back down and things would basically go back to normal. I'm not sure that that's right, but I do think they may believe it. As it relates to the Iranians, I don't know if the Iranians fear an Israeli strike, but they do have to be concerned that if Israel starts something, it could lead to a wider war that draws the Americans in, and that would be something that the Iranians would worry about very, very much. So the combination of sanctions and this kind of shadow of military conflict in the background, I do think provides some leverage on the Iranians, and now it'll be up to our diplomats to try to take advantage of that leverage.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Colin Carl.
Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Colin Carl, who's a professor in the Security Studies program at the Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University from February 2009 to December 2011. He was Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for the Middle East at the Pentagon, and he is the author of States, Scarcity, and Civil Strife in the Developing World, and is a regular consultant to the Department of Defense and the intelligence community. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with the former head of the European desk of the National Security Council, Charles Kupchan, about his new book, No One's World.